In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about healthcare reform and the role that all of us as healthcare consumers can take in that reform. And our guest for the program is, actually we have two, Dr. Tom Minogue is here. He is a psychiatrist in private practice here in our area. He also teaches at the U of I Med School. He is a clinical assistant professor here in Urbana-Champaign. He runs a consulting firm in Monticello, TLM Consulting, which provides teaching seminars to other professionals in one of his areas of special expertise, that's psychiatric diagnosis. He is the author of a book that we'll talk about that's titled We Did All We Could, But Your Healthcare Died. And the subtitle is The Patient's New Role in Vital Reforms. It's published by Wyndham Hall Press. It is his second book. His first, and actually, I think we talked about the first book.
Well actually, yes, David. I was on your program a number of years ago Trust Me, I'm a Doctor came out.
That's right. So that book, Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, Understanding and Surviving Modern Healthcare, that's his other book. And I also am happy to say that joining us by telephone, we have Bob Thaves. He's a cartoonist. You may be familiar with his work. He's the creator of the comic strip Frank and Ernest. He's been doing that since 1972. It appears in over 1,200 papers worldwide, and he's received a lot of recognition for his work. He's at his home, and we're talking with him, too, and he will talk with us maybe a little bit about some of the cartoons that he contributed to the book, and both of the authors can talk about their collaboration on the effort, and your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Minogue, thanks for being here.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to having this discussion with you, but also you may not be aware, David, that Bob Thaves and I have never met.
And No.
And so although we've talked briefly on the phone in the past and mostly emailing to get the book collaborated on, this is really my first opportunity to have really talked very much with Bob. So I'm probably looking forward to this conversation as much as the listeners, because I have a lot of questions for Bob, and I only hope I have a chance to get some of those in.
Well, we'll see what we can do. Well, we better bring him in here. Mr. Thaves, hello.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, you're welcome.
We appreciate it.
Bob, good morning to you. As I just mentioned, I've been looking forward.
Yes, but now you're going to ask the question?
Well, I have a lot of questions to ask you, but mostly I want to find out if Frank and Ernest are going to be commenting on the survivors in the strip.
Oh. Well, we did one.
Oh, have you done one? Okay.
A little while ago, which was a takeoff on Robinson Crusoe and how Friday kicked him off the island.
Oh.
So that's the only one, though, because I've never seen the show, but I recognize that it's a cultural and social phenomenon, and I'm one of the few people in the country, apparently, who's never seen it.
Well, I haven't either, so I'm proud to meet another person who has not seen this program.
Yeah. Well, you know, David, I've been watching Bob's work in the papers for really many years, and it was only about 2 years ago that he and I started collaborating on this book. What really has impressed me is that when I would go into one of the research labs here on campus or in one of the classrooms, that's where I was more likely to see Bob's cartoons up. I mean, of course, I would see them in the local paper and whatever, but it really struck me that Frank and Ernest struck home so much to people that they had to bring it to work with them. And mm-hmm. It's not at all unusual to see his cartoons around campus, and I imagine that's duplicated in other areas. And so he commented frequently on healthcare issues. And you know, to this day, I don't know why he does. That would be one of the questions I would have for Bob. Why indeed are so many of the Frank and Ernest cartoons on healthcare issues? And when I went to Bob, he has a marvelous website. I think it's just frankandernest.com. Is that right, Bob?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And when you sign into his website, you can access thousands of Frank and Ernest cartoons. And so I would go into the website and I would put in like doctor, and I'd get 60, 70 cartoons under doctor. You put in hospital, you get 20, 30 cartoons under hospital. So for many, many years, Bob has been commenting on these healthcare issues, and I would occasionally quote him in classes, lectures I was giving. I wouldn't admit over the air that I've bootlegged some of his cartoons, and the students would be very receptive because there's something special about the visual appeal of these cartoons, and no matter what I might write on paper about the strong feelings I have about healthcare, there's something that I cannot convey that looking at, for instance, the cartoon on the book's cover, which is a fellow with a tube over his head standing before a nurse at a reception desk with the nurse obviously needing some assistance from the nurse, and the nurse asking something like, well, what about 2 weeks from Thursday? Mm-hmm. And no matter how I could describe in words how much we lack the ability often to get people in for appointments and how much they often really need to get in and feel that, you know, that they're not being treated appropriately. I can write that in words and can just kind of lay there. You see Bob's cartoons and it says it much, much better than I can. And it was why I was very excited when Bob was willing to contribute from his archives cartoons. And Bob, as I recall, and you correct me on this, I don't think that it was ever necessary to draw any new cartoons. I know you did quite a bit of work updating those in the book, it seemed to me like that for every topic I could come up with, that you were able to come up with a cartoon that you'd already done on the topic.
Yeah, well, actually, I think you came up with them, drawing from the archive. Yes, all the cartoons in the book are really reprints.
Yes, that's right. It wasn't. We changed a few. I remember you explained to me the process that Frank and Ernest had kind of grown over the years and changed.
Right.
And so we had to be cautious about a 1970 cartoon as compared to a 1999 cartoon.
Yes, because the style has changed a lot over the last, 28 years almost. I prefer to think of it as 10,220 deadlines. which really puts it in perspective.
Well, I'm curious now because since Tom Minow raised the question, let me ask it and ask, is why have you done so many cartoons that have to do with doctors and hospitals? Is there a particular reason, or is it just that that's...
No, I think there's no particular reason. Huh. I think, and excuse my voice, I have an allergy. And so my sinuses are working overtime.
We need to get you some health care, Bob.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, no, there's no particular reason except that I think all cartoonists, use or play upon situations that are important or that play a role in everybody's lives. That is money, banking, jobs, work, bosses, marriage, wives, medical care, so on. And it is just one more of those areas or domains that cartoonists use. We all rely upon heavily upon a lot of stereotyping, both in terms of characters and in situations. But also, I do have some personal convictions or beliefs about medical care in this country. And I'm happy to say I'm not unhappy with my own medical care. I've been blessed by having doctors who I think have been exceptionally good for me. And I have had no personal problems at all with getting what I think is proper care. But as the advent of HMOs and other changes in medical care have evolved, it has concerned me because what I see happening to other people. And so I wanted sometimes to express what my own attitudes were or what my own observations were.
Well, you know, Bob, much along those lines, and again, you and I have never really talked about this,
no.
Which is why I enjoy this opportunity. But I sometimes sit back and look at your cartoons and try to figure out if you're a Democrat or Republican. And I have no idea. And I have written the book apolitically because my feeling is that health care, while it touches the political arena and we need to address it in a political arena, is first and foremost a personal and a social phenomenon, not a political issue. And I'm not literally asking you the question, well, what is your political affiliation, but simply kind of pointing out that you and I have never really dealt with this issue on that level. What I think both of us have tried to do is to you visually and me in words to address concerns that we saw within the healthcare system, and it wasn't a matter of what candidate supported or brought up those concerns with us, but rather what we saw the needs to be, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I am neither Republican nor Democrat. I vote, I participate, but I'm a registered independent.
That's interesting.
By that I mean I am not declared as I have no allegiance to any party. So that leaves me free in a sense, but yes, there are just really two premises that are the basis of my approach to the health issue, and that is the first one is that each person has a personal responsibility for his own health. That is, I don't think my doctors are responsible for my health. I am.
Yes.
And actually nobody else is. I can do much to control it or to determine what it is by how I choose to live, how I choose to behave, what I choose to eat, and whether I choose to exercise and so on or not. But basically it comes down to me. But I do believe the second principle for me is that I think everybody is entitled to access to medical professionals to help me, to help each of us. And that is the only place I think where politics may enter into it, in that I think there is undoubtedly a role for government in that.
Well, Bob, I think, you know, that's certainly one of the major thrusts of this particular book, that everyone should have health care. I used to kind of debate with myself that proverbial question, is it a privilege or a right to get health care? And ultimately, for me, it's pretty well become a non-issue. It's simply something that I feel is appropriate. I don't know if people are entitled to it, if it's a privilege, if it's a right, but I would not want to be the neighbor, whether we're talking literally or figuratively my neighbor, would not want to be neighbor with someone who wasn't entitled to exactly the quality of health care that I get. And I'd want to see that provided for other folks. And if we want to politicize it and call it rights or privileges or whatever and vote on it, that may be what we have to do. But the bottom line is, you know, if we can't find it in the Constitution one way or another, it doesn't bother me. When someone needs care, and unfortunately, I see folks coming into the office with just kind of horror stories of difficulties that they have had, working in something of a referral area. You know, I have the advantage of getting in a wide range of people from widely diverse areas, and they bring in their, you know, their tales that they can't get appointments, they can't afford copays, they can't afford their prescriptions. They have concerns of diagnosis and misdiagnosis. So I see a lot of problems that people here have in getting their health care. And it seemed to me like having been around the block a few times in the healthcare arena myself, that there was a certain obligation to share some of that information. And I don't know if David at some point wants to get into it, but I mean, I think really the basic thrust of this book, which you so nicely illustrated, is that these days we have serious concerns about America's healthcare. And I think with legitimate reason, and in my mind, with these concerns that have come up, it's time. We've had experts trying to deal with this, the politicians and the bureaucrats and the academicians. Certainly physicians have made effort, and many of them have been well taken. But we have not seen the strength of both the individual patient in improving America's health care. And I'm not speaking of your issue, which I think is extremely well taken, of we're all primarily responsible. You're absolutely right. But I'm speaking the individual taking responsibility for improving our system of health care. I've not seen a strength of that, nor have I seen the growth that I would like to see of the consumer movement. And I think we're seeing stronger and stronger consumer efforts, certainly here in Champaign. And you're probably not familiar with this, Bob, but we have a very strong healthcare consumers group. And, you know, I may not always agree with what they have to say, but I think that it behooves physicians and consumers to realize that we're working for the same goals, that yes, we can both recognize that there are serious concerns, and we do not have to be at odds as we try to remedy some of these.
I should probably introduce again our guest here for anybody who's tuned in the last little bit. Here in studio with us is Tom Minogue. He is a psychiatrist. He has practice here in our area. He also teaches U of I Med School. And he is the co-author. I'm not sure if that's exactly the right term. Anyway, he's authored a book, the text part of a book, which looks at the patient's role in health reform. He has titled the book, We Did All We Could, But Your Healthcare Died. And his collaborator is Bob Thaves, who is the creator of the Frank and Ernest cartoon strip, and he's contributed cartoons that make, in a different sort of way, some of the same points that Tom does with the text. And the book is published by Wyndham Hall Press. And in fact, I think you're going to be doing a book signing this weekend.
Tomorrow at Pages.
At Pages for All Ages.
I don't expect anyone will be there. This is the Champaign-Urbana Sweet Corn Festival. So a strong competition for a book signing.
Well, they can go both. They can go both places.
But that's right. I think 2 to 4 tomorrow afternoon at Pages. And certainly looking forward to having people come and discuss their concerns of health care. It's actually a joint press conference with the Champaign County healthcare consumers, who I think will have a lot to say in terms of what's coming up on the political agenda.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to raise one point with you, Dr. Minogue, and that's, I think that when people talk about healthcare and they talk about the things that make them unhappy, one of the things that's at the top of the list is the relationship they have with their doctor, particularly if they're in managed care. People say, I don't get to spend enough time with the doctor. I'm not able to ask all of my questions. The doctor is not able to get to know me as a person. That seems to be one of the big complaints. And in the book, you sort of make the point that people, in as much as they can, need to take control and be very much involved in their own care.
Yes.
How, and if indeed you're in an HMO, so there are some limits placed on the amount of time you can spend with your doctor, what can you do about that?
Well, I don't know that I would really want to restrict it just to HMOs because, you know, I think we might see that problem more pronounced in that kind of setting. But I have to tell you about a marvelous incident just about 2 or 3 weeks ago in the office. There's the nicest senior citizen, an older lady that I work with. That she always comes in with a friend to kind of be supportive during the appointments. And the two of them always sit there and take notes during the and it's like having two secretaries in the room every time I say something, which I admire them for. You know, they're really getting things down and working hard. And we had the appointment time had gone on, and I thought I had pretty well covered the issues. I don't frankly know if this was an HMO patient or not, and I'd like to think that patients are not necessarily treated as you're an HMO patient and you're not, but this was a patient, a senior citizen, and so I stood up and said, well, I think that's probably what we'll be covering today, and let's get you a return appointment for about another month. And this lady, I think she's maybe about a little bit, around 80, and she said to me, she said, no, you'll sit down. I'd already stood up. You'll sit down. I still have questions to ask you. And I thought that was absolutely marvelous. And I think that's the first time. And I mean, I've been in practice, well, in psychiatry now for about 20 years, but I've been in general medical and other practice for about 30 years. I've never had a patient tell me, no, the appointment's not over. You're going to sit down and answer my questions. And I just thought this was a marvelous example of exactly what people should do if they feel that they're not having their issues addressed in any other fashion. So certainly that's one of the things that they can do, that, you know, they certainly need to be assertive. They also can do, and maybe this is a little bit in line with what Bob was saying about being responsible for our own health, but in a different sort of way. People often waste an awful lot of appointment time. And if what people need to learn how to do is to become managers of their appointments. And certainly, you know, the doctor has an agenda. When you go in to see a doctor, doctor knows he's going to take a history, do a physical, make a diagnosis, lay out a treatment plan. I mean, we do this time and time and time, sometimes every 3 minutes, depending on how your appointments are scheduled. But hopefully, you know, for 15 or 20, 30-minute appointments. And we have an agenda that we manage. But the patient has to come in with their own agenda. The patient needs to know what they are there for. And it has to be very clear. And I'll frequently ask patients, you know, will you please just tell me in one nice, clear, crisp sentence, what is the distress that brings you in to see me? Mm-hmm. And people have tremendous trouble grappling with that. And I would like to think that people can come in more prepared. Now, it's not that. Certainly patients have limitations, and they're not on their own turf when they're in the doctor's office. This isn't a let's shift blame or blame the victim, but you're asking what patients can do. And I think to better manage their own appointment time, and one simple thing, and I always tell patients this, I think I learned from my accountant who always says, throw all of your bills in a brown paper bag and bring them into your tax appointment. You just take all of your medicines before you see me. You put those in a brown paper bag and you bring those in, because I want to know. So often they'll come in and they'll say, because I'm always interested in drug interactions. It's a very serious issue these days. I'll always ask them, have any new drugs been added since your last visit? Because I'll make sure they're not going to have trouble with the medicine I prescribed. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, yeah, one of the doctors ordered a new pink pill for me, and which, you know, when I go to put that in the computer, that doesn't help very much. But if people will bring in their medicines, or at least know what medicines they're taking, know what dosages, so I think they can really prepare and do a lot more for themselves just in terms of managing an office appointment.
Yeah. I think one of the things that you hear doctors say all the time is that the patients come in and they sit down and they talk with the doctor. And they take, you know, whatever time is allowed, and then they're almost finished, and the doctor says something like, so is there anything else, you know, sort of on your mind? And then they tell you why they really came.
Yes.
And that it's something that for something obviously is really bothering them, but for some reason they feel that they can't be up front about, that they can't right at the beginning say, look, doc, this is what it is.
Well, that's a phenomenon that happens. But again, it gets back to the idea of properly managing your appointments. Now we should really just very briefly take a step back from that. It's unfortunate that patients have to manage appointments so carefully. You know, I mean, we haven't really hit on what are the problems, but certainly one of the problems, I think, is that in spite of all this talk about doctor's glut, we still don't have enough doctors. And it should, you know, you can go and talk to your attorney for an hour, and he or she doesn't move you out of the office unduly rapidly. But it's hard to go in to talk to your doctor for a half hour, an hour and a half. And I simply think that one of the real problems we're facing is that we do not have enough doctors, and we need to have patients have that flexibility to be able to say, okay, you dealt with that, and by the way, here is something else.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. People, I think, might, though, object being on the same terms with their lawyers. If they came in and they said to their doctor, I think I'd like to have an hour of your time, the doctor would say, okay, that'll be $200. I'm not sure how that would work.
Well, but the thing is, people are already currently paying $200 for an hour of their doctor's time. So I'm not sure that there's a great deal of difference there. And patients in general, David, do not know. I mean, when you see your doctor, do you know how long your appointment is scheduled for?
I have no idea.
See, you know it's a 2:20 appointment, but you don't know if it ends at 2:15, at 2:20, 2:30, 3 o'clock. And so I think one of the things people can do is to say, when the receptionist, when they make the appointment, the receptionist says, we'll see you at 3 o'clock then, Mr. Jones. And then say, well, how long is that appointment scheduled for? And then he might want to say, you know, I don't think 10 minutes is going to be enough for this because I have several things. I'd like you to let's pick another time when doctor can see me for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. I think that's very legitimate, David.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough. We have a caller here locally. Let's do that. We'll talk with them. Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Minogue. Could you expound on your comment that you think there are not enough doctors? Because apparently there's been a lot of talk over the last few years of closing medical schools and a glut of specialists. So while I might agree with you, I don't know if the industry's prevailing attitude is jibes with yours.
Well, to the caller, I don't think the industry's prevailing attitude does jive with mine. I think that there's really two issues. One, the total number of doctors, and then secondly, the doctors in specialty practice. You know, I don't think it's any great mystery that, to me at least, that there's not enough doctors. Just call around. We're not talking necessarily locally now, but when people call to get appointments, they are frequently told, well, we can see you in 3 weeks or 4 weeks, or it can be pretty hard to get seen the same day. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some options. A lot of places have convenient cares, and there's walk-in clinics, docs in the box. You can always go to the emergency room. So hopefully, you know, there are facilities available. But just in terms of seeing your own doctor on a regular basis, I just don't think, and I think this is common experience that people have, and it's what's illustrated on the front cover of the book with the guy with the tube over the head being told to come back in 2 weeks. I just think you don't have to look at the statistics. You don't have to look at research. Just call a doctor's office and see how long it takes to get an appointment. And I think that just tells me that there are not enough doctors. Now, the specialty question is an important one. Care is just very, very complicated these days. And while I think it's important to have a strong primary care doctor to work with, I don't think that we should be concerned about abusing SIF systems because we're seeing a lot of specialists. I'm in the field of psychiatry, and I'll tell you, I have all I can do to keep abreast in the world of psychiatry. Very, very difficult. And I see specialists in my own care. Saw a gastroenterologist yesterday. Pleased to be able to do that. I think we need more doctors with a strong family practice, primary care base, but we need more specialists too. And if the industry disagrees with that, I'd like them to tell me how long they wait for their own appointments.
Well, that's it, that one of the things that if you were selecting a doctor, one of the things that you might do as you're, if you have a choice and you're calling around, you might say, okay, today, I want to make an appointment today. How long is it really going to take me before the doctor will see me?
Right. And I think that would be very reasonable to do that. You know, does a doctor in general work in emergency patients? And in fact, can you even talk to your doctor? I think a lot of people these days have the experience that it's hard to call in and actually talk to your physician. They might call in, and I think this is probably true in many parts of the country, that they'll call in and first they'll get on hold from the receptionist. And then when they reach the receptionist, they'll get into the nurse's voicemail or put on hold for the nurse. And then maybe ultimately we'll hear back kind of second or third hand from the doctor. Well, can you actually talk to your doctor when you call in for questions? And I think throughout the country, people are having trouble doing this.
I want to just go back here for a second to our other guest, Bob Thaves. And I'm interested in asking a question. I know that from having seen the strip, obviously, for a long time, I know that you do raise political and social issues in the strip, and yet I think do it in a sometimes kind of a gentle way that maybe makes people more receptive to the idea than if it was a cartoon that had a little bit more edge to it. I just wonder how you approach that that idea, and in fact whether you ever wanted to be an editorial cartoonist and be very clear that I am, that this cartoon is about making a political point, no bones about it.
Yeah. No, I never had any wish to be an editorial cartoonist. Excuse me. In part because I started out as a magazine cartoonist, which gives you total freedom to do anything you want to do. And I wouldn't want to be confined, one thing, to the political arena. Plus, I don't particularly like what I would think of as mean humor. And much of editorial cartooning, although it legitimately makes a point, it makes it a point through what I think of as mean humor. Excuse me, go ahead.
Oh, Bob, I was just going to say I've noticed the same thing, and interestingly enough, I mean, the same thing in your cartoons, and interestingly enough, David's question of what about you being an editorial cartoon was one of mine. I mean, that was, you know, certainly I had the same thought, but a comment along those lines with regard to your cartoons is a certain, David mentioned a softness or a gentleness to them, but many of them also have a certain universality. I know at least one or two that are used in this book. One is your characters one saying to the other, and it doesn't matter what they were really be talking about, but one was saying to the other, wait a minute, this isn't one of those let's take responsibility for our own actions deals, is it? and another one was God watching people fall off of a flat earth and having a discussion with the people up in heaven of, well, I guess it's time to go to plan B, kind of indicating that sometimes we have to shift gears and retool our thinking. Right. And I've always enjoyed kind of the universality of some of these cartoons, and I think that David's right. They lack that bitter edge while still getting across a marvelous message. And I remember, Bob, in one of our very brief conversations, you tried to explain to me once something about the language of cartooning, and I'm sure I could do to relearn that. Can you give a 30-second...
I'm not quite sure what I said.
I think basically you were saying that it's almost like a third language or a different language when one sits down with cartooning, and that you were just able to kind of instill, you know, use that language to get an idea across in a different way than words do.
I was probably touching on it when I said something about how we use stereotypes and how we draw up.
Yes.
Everyday, the concerns or the experiences of everyday people, but the arts in general, I think of as being different languages. Music is a different language, as far as I'm concerned. I listen to music almost constantly while I work, and I've often thought that I cannot put into words what I feel when I hear the music, and that's because music is its own language. And I think art, whether the visual arts are their own language, and the unique thing perhaps about cartooning is that it combines verbal, a verbal construction with what is really a visual art.
Yes.
That there is no other case, as far as I know, of where that's true, other than, unless you want to talk about opera and music. But anyway, the idea of it being... not having an edge, so to speak, is I think people can tolerate it more when the character makes fun of himself, so to speak, rather than making fun of some other person. And it also I think every art, every creative effort is a projection of in some way or another of the creator. And I have never myself enjoyed making fun of people or treating things what I think of as being in a mean spirit. It always makes me very uncomfortable. And I would like to see that in my cartoons. In Frank and Ernest usually make fun of themselves, not of other people. And I think that makes it easier also for people to read them and accept them. That it certainly isn't threatening in any sense. Hmm. Does that help at all?
Oh, well, I think so. It makes tremendous sense to me.
Thank you for that explanation, Ben.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are getting down to the point here where we have maybe about 12 or 13 minutes left. Time's been going very quickly. I want to make sure if people who are listening, if you have a question or a comment you'd like to join us, you can do that. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free 800-222-9455. And our two guests are cartoonist Bob Thaves. He's the creator of the comic strip Frank and Ernest, and Dr. Tom Minogue. He is a psychiatrist, and he's authored a book titled We Did All We Could, But Your Healthcare Died. And Bob Thaves has contributed cartoons. And the idea is that it's a discussion of the issue of healthcare reform, what perhaps is wrong with healthcare in this country, how it might be changed, and the role of the patient.
Yeah,
that change.
And in fact, maybe, David, it might be worthwhile just to mention briefly why the title was chosen.
Sure.
Of course, you're familiar with the old saying, as the doctor comes out of the surgery room, we did all we could, but, the patient died. And I think that as a physician, I'm not ashamed to recognize that there are serious dangers and problems and risks in healthcare, and there's been it's documented in the literature now that healthcare can be very dangerous, and I think doctors in general try very hard to keep it safe, but that doesn't mean that we've done the job that we're ultimately capable of doing. One very interesting figure is that the number of hospital deaths per day in the United States may be equivalent to two airliners colliding in midair every day. And, you know, one submarine goes down and it's news for how long? 130 people die. Well, the research suggests that hundreds of people die every day in the hospital. But yet, you know, where is the fire and where is the fevered pitch to really bring some changes to this? There was a recent study that the World Health Organization brought out about the ranking of the quality of healthcare systems in the world. The U.S. was 37th. Well, you know, we spend 15% of our gross domestic product on healthcare, and yet we're 37th. And France was number one. Italy was number two. United Kingdom was number 18. But we're sitting down there at 37. We have a high infant mortality rate. We don't have as good of a life expectancy as we should have. So I think that there's some kind of an accumulation of evidence in recent years that, yes, we're spending a lot of money, and we're on a one-to-one basis, doctor and patient sitting down, there may be a lot of satisfaction, and but the statistics, which one can argue with certainly, but you know, these statistics are from very legitimate organizations, from published in JAMA, for instance, from the World Health Organization. So I think there's reason for patients and consumers to work together and say, yes, there's reason for very serious concern. And I would love to hear from people why this isn't really on the lips of everyone, the concern. I looked in the two Chicago papers today, didn't find anything at all about the politics for the coming presidential election. Not one article, and I went through them fairly rapidly, but certainly nothing jumped out at me, either Republican, Democratic, Ralph Nader, anyone who was saying, okay, now here's an important item in our health nation's healthcare debate. I mean, there are sometimes, but it seems like things just mechanically fall from the lips of the candidate. You know, oh, patient's bill of rights, you know, that's great, some prescription benefits. But we have all these people who are coming in to see doctors saying, I can't afford medicine, people dying for their lack of health care. And I would love for the listeners to call in and say, well, why? Where is that fire? Where is that concern?
Maybe I'll give the telephone number again here in case somebody would like to call in and remind you that we do have about 10, or now less than 10 minutes left, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Let me ask Bob Thaves. I'm just curious if you have some, just as somebody who obviously observes the political scene and sometimes reflects that in your work, if you have some sort of thought about why it is that this issue, as important as it seems to be, doesn't get more attention.
Why the medical one?
Yeah.
Well, in part, I think because I don't think the politicians have a solution, and also part of it is what I think Dr. Minogue has referred to, and that is that people aren't clamoring for it.
So you didn't hear, I'm turning back to Tom Minogue here. You are actually not expecting, see, we got a little presidential election going here. You heard that. And as you've noted, there have been a few things that have been discussed.
Sure,
people were talking about prescription drugs for people on Medicare.
Yeah.
Here we sort of tinker with the system on the edges, but nobody is really talking about, at least I haven't heard anybody lately talking about really dramatically changing the system that we have. You don't think that that's, we're going to hear that?
Well, let's talk about it, although I'm not a presidential candidate, but can still talk about it. But I think you're absolutely right. We have this bits and pieces, tinker at the edge approach to it. And I do believe, though, that Al Gore, and this isn't to come out and support, I do believe that Al Gore, in his acceptance speech, said that we will move to universal health coverage in this country. And I'm not endorsing his plan by any means, or disparaging it, but I certainly feel that instead of we can sue our HMO and we can have prescription drug benefits and we will have this CHIP program for kids and we'll support immunizations and all, isn't it time to get a universal program to cut all the monkeying around at the edges and get a universal program that is supportive of everyone, where everyone can take responsibility in. I mean, we don't have to talk just about a government giveaway that, you know, government's just going to give this money away. But we do know that we spend $1 trillion a year in healthcare. Why not make that available to individuals, but make them responsible for it, but yet through a program that would allow them to take responsibility for their own trillion? Because, I mean, ultimately, I mean, you work for the University of Illinois. They're paying you a certain amount, and they probably give you health care service. But in the bottom line is that you're paying for that through your work. And so why not give to you and to everyone in this country access, if you will, to their share of the trillion? Let them be financially responsible for paying for that and to manage it well. And I think that we can do that. I think we can have good universal coverage. Whether or not it should be by a single payer, that's another issue.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them in the time that's left here. Champagne is up next, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I certainly agree with what the doctor's been saying. I think we have to be responsible. And also regarding universal care, we have some friends in Canada, and it seems to be working quite well there. I was wondering if the doctor could comment on the a comparison of our system and the cost and the Canadian system and the advantages and disadvantages. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Well, the Canadian system, one sometimes hears disparaging remarks about it. But when I go up to meetings in Canada and talk to the people up there, they're very satisfied with their system. And I know that they bring it in at a much lower cost than we do. And they've been at it for a number of years. I'm not sure I can. I mean, I'm not a research person or an academician. I'm a practitioner, so I'm not sure I could compare the German to the Canadian to whatever system. But I do know that there's a lot of satisfaction with the Canadian system, that it is universal, that they don't wind up sending out bills, and everyone gets covered, and that there's a general level of satisfaction. And I think that we could have a lot to learn from the Canadian system.
Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, the one also always hears those stories, and perhaps these are from people who want to argue against universal health care, that says, ah, yes, but when something really important comes along, Canadians, what do? They go across the border and they come to the United States. They're concerned about how long it may wait for a particular procedure, or maybe it is that the system there would review your case and say, well, maybe you want to have this done, but we don't think it's necessary, so we're not going to pay for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure, David, that one has to buy into the Canadian or any other system and block. Mm-hmm. I think who has a perfect system in air travel or anything? But I think there's something to be learned from our neighbors to the north, that they've done a fairly decent job of being sure that there's a reasonably level playing field in healthcare.
One other call here. This is also Champagne. This is line number two. Hello.
Am I on line number two?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I've read your first book.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a firm believer in preventative medicine, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to practice because many of the tests that I have read are necessary, are being cut out, and it's difficult to get them. For instance, urine analysis has been cut out from physical exams by most of the doctors in the Champaign-Urbana area. And also, instead of doing pre-screening colonoscopics, they're doing barium x-rays. And one does not know exactly what procedures to use to change this.
Well, the caller brings up a number of interesting points. You know, the core of it is a question of prevention. And while testing is important and certainly has changed over the years, a really important element of prevention is some simple basics that we keep forgetting about. I'm going to keep this real short because I know we have some other callers.
Yes.
But testing is fine. But what about that time to go in and have your doctor take a good history? surgery and to do a good hands-on physical. I think that may be disappearing in this country at least as much as a lot of routine testing is. And certainly in the old days, I mean, I used to be a family doc. Someone would come in, we'd order 5, 6, 7 tests routinely. Now folks feel in medicine that they're more targeting the test. We don't really need this one. Let's get what we really need. But the bottom line is that we ought to use the tests appropriately as necessary. I would certainly support that. But we also need to go back to where doctors are talking to patients, spending time with them, and doing good solid exams. That's a real good part of preventive medicine.
I'll just make one more comment for a physical exam. Last year, with a new doctor, she spent 15 minutes and ran out and said, make another appointment. I went back 3 times for 15 minutes.
Well, you'd probably be one of those folks who would agree we don't have a doctor's glut then.
I don't have a doctor. And what do you do about it?
Yeah. Well, let's support getting more doctors in this country and then be like the patient who wouldn't let me leave the room until she was done asking me the questions. Tell the doctor to sit back down.
You tried that.
I did.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. I am afraid we're going to have to leave it at that because we've used up our time. We want to say to our guests, thanks very much, Mr. Thaves. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Talking with us today. Bob Thaves, he's a cartoonist, creator of Frank and Ernest, and he also contributed cartoons to the book here that Tom Minogue has done. He's provided the text. The title of the book is We Did All We Could, But Your Healthcare Died. He is a physician, a psychiatrist in practice here in our area. He also teaches at the U of I Med School. The book is published by Wyndham Hall Press, is available in bookstores, and as we mentioned before, he'll be doing a book signing at Pages for All Ages tomorrow.
At 2 o'clock, and Bob, just wanted to say to you, it was kind of nice meeting you today over the radio. Appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much for participating.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Great, and thanks to both of you.